It was on Easter Sunday, exactly 100 years ago, that the Titanic sank. That's why there are so many television programs going on about it at the moment. A luxury liner about which one employee allegedly said, not even God Almighty could sink this ship. Well, it struck an iceberg at 11:40 that night. It sank within 3 hours. There were 17 millionaires on board. The first-class fare cost over £800 in 100 years ago money. And it included an 11-course meal each evening. That had to be bad for your health. Others paid just £2 for a very different style of journey to start a new life in the brave new world of the United States of America. And the ocean swallowed both indiscriminately in the darkness. And took as well, by the way, the vicar of our sister church, St. Paul's Portman Square, as it was called then. Of over 2,000 passengers and crew, only 705 survived, along with two lapdogs. They were the only ones to escape the icy waters of the Atlantic. More than 1,500 people were lost. And the story of the most famous ship since Noah's Ark had ended in tragedy and entered the realms of legend. Well, as we turn to Mark's gospel, as we look here at that first Easter Sunday, the iceberg has been struck. And as Jesus was nailed to the cross on Good Friday, the story which carried so many hopes also ends in tragedy. And when Mark picks up the tale in chapter 16, it seems it's really just to tidy up the details. I mean, look at verse 1. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Not a flicker of hope, is there? Not a trace of expectation, not a hint that what is about to happen is any hallucinatory wish fulfillment. Just the realism, as in their sorrow they realize what they've forgotten. Verse 2, very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb and they asked each other, who will roll the stone away from the entrance to the tomb? How are we going to get in? If you've ever forgotten your keys, you know that question. And you can almost sense the heads going down, can't you? The feet going slower, already heavy hearts getting heavier. A sad exercise was just becoming a pointless one. Verse 4, but when they looked up, now the whole scenario changed. But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. And as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in white, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Well, who wouldn't be? I mean, this is a tomb. The women are probably emotionally shot through and exhausted before they started. Now, instead of a corpse, they find themselves face to face with a living stranger. And yet that's when shock and despair turn to hope. I mean, look at verse 6. Don't be alarmed, he said. You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. No sense they've come to the wrong tomb, by the way, nor that the stranger is talking about somebody else. He has risen, he goes on. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. Check it out. It stands up to the evidence. He has risen. He is not here. Seven words that sum up an Easter faith. And if you say, what does Easter faith look like? Well, let me take these moments to try and tease out four truths. Four truths from those seven words. Here's the first of them. It's not confined to a place. It's not confined to a place. Leaders of great movements so often get linked to a place. And when they die, there's only one place where you can visit them. You've only got to go up the road to visit Karl Marx's tomb in Highgate Cemetery. But you'll have to go to Medina in Saudi Arabia to visit Muhammad's grave, and millions do each year. Go to Jerusalem, visit the garden tomb where Jesus is meant to have been buried, and you'll see these words there. He has risen. he is not here. And Easter faith is not confined to a church building, never mind a memorial site. A risen Lord can't be tied down like that. A religion that is confined to a church or a memorial has not met with Easter. Christ is as near to the brother and sister Christian in the middle of nowhere in the bush in Sudan as he is to the believer in a cathedral like Canterbury or the pilgrim at the Garden Tomb. He's risen. He's not here, not confined to a place. Secondly, not confined to the good. The Jesus story never was for the good or for the religious. So if you think of yourself in those categories, listen carefully this morning. Friend of tax collectors and sinners is what they call Jesus. And even the tragedy of the cross looks different once you hear he is risen. He is not here. I mean, look at verse 7. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. His disciples and Peter. Peter the failure. Peter the one who denied him. Peter who bottled it in front of a servant girl. The Peter who would never have imagined he still had a place at the table, a part to play in the team without those words and Peter. Peter, the source for so much of Mark's gospel, who makes sure those two words, so priceless to him, keep their place in the final edition and keep hope for others who, for whatever reason, would write themselves off as not good enough or not up to it. And as he told you. I mean, the only storyline the women have been operating on is the obvious one: arrest, trial, execution, the end. But now here's a reminder that there always has been a different one to follow. When they get the DVD out, so to speak, and replay what Jesus said, they'll realize Good Friday was not just a tragic accident. He'd always said it would come to this. The Son of Man must suffer many things, and he must be killed. Jesus had said it time and time and time again. And he'd die for a purpose. He'd give his life as a ransom for many. His body would be broken for you. He'd shed his blood for the forgiveness of sins. Well, he'd given his life, all right. His body had been broken. They'd seen it happen in front of them. His blood had been shed. But the rest of it? The sins forgiven, the ransom paid, the judgment taken, was that just wishful thinking? He has risen. He is not here. I mean, those seven words give substance to all of Jesus' claims, which kept on ending, and on the third day rise again. An Easter faith embraces the sinner, forgives the failure, and does it because of, not in spite of, the cross. Not confined to a place, not confined to the good, not confined, thirdly, to this world. Jesus often spoke of another world very different to this broken one. Visionaries often do. But then visionaries often turn out to be no more than dreamers, don't they? And cynics have a field day. A new creation, a new world where the lion lies down with the lamb, says the Bible. Yes, but the lamb won't sleep very well, quipped Woody Allen. But for once, he is the one with blinkers on. He has risen. He is not here. Seven words that shatter all our paradigms. Seven words that insist there is a life beyond the grave and a world beyond this one. Roger Dworkin, the American philosopher, said of death, "Death sucks. It's not only the start of nothing, but it's the end of everything." Another American, Billy Graham, the great Christian evangelist with a strong Easter faith, has written what's almost certainly his last book. He starts it like this: "I never thought I would live to be this old. All my life I was taught how to die as a Christian, but no one ever taught me how I ought to live in the years before I die. I wish they had, because I'm an old man now, and believe me, it's not easy. Whoever first said it was right, old age is not for sissies. Get any group of older people together, and I can almost guarantee what their favorite topic of conversation will be, their latest aches and pains. I will soon celebrate my 93rd birthday, and I know it won't be long before God calls me home to heaven. More than ever, I look forward to that day. Not just because of the wonders I know heaven holds in store for me and for every believer, but because I know that finally all the burdens and sorrows that press down upon me at this stage of my life will be over. During the last year, the physical ailments common to old age really have taken their toll on me. And I also look forward to that day because I will be reunited with Ruth, my beloved wife and best friend for almost 64 years, who went home in 2007 to be with the Lord she loved and served so faithfully. Although I rejoice that her struggles with weakness and pain have all come to an end, I still feel as if a part of me has been ripped out, and I miss her far more than I ever could have imagined. No, old age is not for sissies. See, he's 93, but he doesn't call the book the final chapter. He calls it Nearing Home. He's 93. He's not in denial about death, and he's still looking forward to the future. An Easter faith is not confined to this world. Not confined to a place, not confined to the good, not confined to this world. And an Easter faith cannot confine Jesus. Cannot confine Jesus. As Mark tells his story, you sense that for the women engaging with all this, rerunning the DV, realizing what Jesus had actually been saying, that still lies in the future. And he finishes his gospel with loose ends, anything but tied up, so much so that some added verses 9 to 20 to round things off better. Some have wondered if the real ending has been lost, but that's highly unlikely, as on a papyrus, the ending is the most protected bit right on the inside next to the spool. Indeed, Mark seems to have deliberately finished leaving things hanging in the air. Look at verse 8 again. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. What's going on? I don't think the women are working out doctrinal consequences of all this. Their minds are full of Jesus. They've come for him in spite of hearts broken because of what's happened to him, hopes crushed because of what's happened to him. Now they've been hit with the impact of those seven words. He has risen. He is not here. Why the fear? Well, put it this way. Mark begins his account, his whole gospel, like this. He says he's writing the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. Now, when we come across a phrase like the Son of God, we immediately start thinking relationally, Father and Son. But actually in the Bible, it's a title for God's King. And in the culture of the day, it was a title too. It's what nearly every Roman emperor called himself, the Son of God. See, Mark says he's writing an edgy story. This is the story of Jesus, a bigger than the emperor figure, with good news for us. And these women had lived the story. They'd been on the emotional roller coaster. They'd touched the heights with the triumphal entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. You remember it? The thousands cheering and lining the way. They'd plunged the depths with Jesus executed and buried. Now they're coming to terms with those seven words. He has risen. He is not here. They're discovering that the truth is dawning on their stunned minds that Jesus is, after all, God's King. That those self-appointed sons of God, the Roman emperors, will have to bow their knee to him. Jesus is king in a way that breaks the mold of every Roman or Greek hero. His death and resurrection are unique to him. His absence from that tomb is God's clearest verdict on Jesus and every human attempt to confine him. It's worth a few moments of silence. And the fear? Oh, that's real. That's real. And it's not simple terror. It's the holy, awesome fear that grips people when they see God in action. He has risen. He's not here. See, tell me, what would be more frightening than to discover you've been part of a people who have crucified God's King? The only thing I can think of is having crucified him to discover he's alive again. He has risen. He's not here. No wonder they're trembling and bewildered and afraid. What better way to end the story? 7 words. He has risen. He is not here. And the Easter faith they describe, not confined to a place, not confined to the good, not confined to this world, and cannot confine Jesus. The Titanic's voyage began with 3 classes of passengers. They were strictly divided on board ship. But at the end, there were only 2 classes. The Titanic belonged to the White Star Line, and their offices in Liverpool placed a large board on either side of the entrance, and in big letters on one was written, "Known to be saved." And in big letters on the other was written, "Known to be lost." It's like that in life. And this Jesus, how we relate to God's rescuer King, decides which board we find our names on. Saved or lost? A Belfast man, a stoker on the Titanic, stayed for a drink in a bar in Southampton and missed the ship. He was replaced by another stoker who just happened to be sitting on the dockside looking for work. The Belfast man was listed as lost. 3 days later, to his wife's understandable surprise, he returned home. When he was asked about it afterwards, he used to say, "Someone else died for me." Followers of Jesus say that too. In a few minutes' time, you get your chance to preach. As you eat the bread, drink the wine at communion, you're saying to anyone who's watching, "Someone else died for me." You know, the most dodgy character in church this morning. The kind of, how does he imagine he'd ever be part of God's kingdom person? As he eats and drinks, explains, "Someone else died for me. Jesus took my sins and dealt with them on the cross." The most respectable, upright person here, the "of course she'd be in the kingdom" person, when she eats and drinks, will also be preaching the same sermon. "Someone else died for me. I'm relying on Jesus too. He's my hope." So tell me, can you preach that sermon this morning? Is your Easter faith real? "Someone else died for me." That's what makes us family. So would you stand as we say together the words of the peace and remind ourselves of that? Here's our identity as a family. Christ is our peace. He has reconciled us to God in one body by the cross. We meet in his name and share his peace. The peace of the Lord be always with you. Well, let's sing of all that made that possible. See what a morning, gloriously bright, with the dawning of hope in Jerusalem.